Well, good morning for Tuesday, May 7th. This is the BrianMadden.com podcast.
Nice.
And well done, Jack.
Jack, today's Jack's birthday, so he got to do the introduction. So happy birthday, Jack.
Ah, thank you, guys. I was going to make a note about how, so like last night you decided to call it the BrianMadden.com podcast, so it's no longer Brian and Gabe Live, which means that I'm not excluded by not being in the title because, you know, I'm in most of the shows. But now really it's gone from Brian and Gabe. You know, it could have been Brian and Gabe and Jack, but instead it's just Brian's name.
Yeah.
That's nice. It could have been Brian and Gabe get jacked. But
so
we've just gone back to Brian's name.
Yeah. Hey, start your own company, then you can have your own show. So
noted.
This has been the first show that we've done in a little while, and we had a list somewhere of things to talk about, which I have lost. Here it is.
It's in our email.
All right.
Now we kind of forgot how we do a show. I'm actually giving the show from the front driver's seat of my truck because my house is getting a roof put on it because grapefruit-sized hail decided to fall on it a few weeks ago, and so you know if we hear any weird sounds, let's blame it on the truck.
Yeah, and so. Is your air conditioner off now?
I have my air conditioner turned down in the truck. It's also pretty warm today, which is perfect for putting on a roof, but not so hot for sitting in your truck on a podcast.
Yeah.
I also have a slightly dodgy cell phone connection, it looks like. So this is just the best day.
Okay. Well, so anyway, we've got the chat window open. There's some craziness. So I see Guy, have we met before? We were talking about that. Like, I don't know, Guy, if you're going to be in... I assume you're at Bri Forum. We were trying to talk about if we met before because there was some, you know, words exchanged on Twitter, and is that Gabe's construction truck?
I'm moving down the street to get a better signal.
Wait. Oh, that's all right. Anyway, so Bri Forum. Here's my point. We've got Bri Forum next week in London. I'm hoping that. You know, I think we're in good shape as far as the show goes. I know Gabe and I are giving a session together, and the session is going to be sort of we're going to do a bunch of mini sessions about all sorts of different topics, and maybe some of the stuff we talk about today can be topics for our session. I know Jack, you're giving your session on enterprise mobility. What's a quick preview of that?
The quick preview of the session is that the session will be a quick preview of my upcoming book. So in reality, it's probably in concept quite similar to the session that I gave last year, which was sort of the story of enterprise mobility management and MDM and MAM, except last year we didn't even use the term enterprise mobility management, and so much has changed. And in that time, I've also spent the last 9 months refining that story and how to tell it and really understanding the space. So it'll be a good preview of the book.
It'll be a better version of your session you gave last year, is what you're saying.
In, you know, I was putting it in a little bit nicer way.
Yeah, you would be a good marketing person.
I would say without a doubt.
I mean, you'd be a marketing person for a vendor. Like, remember that session I did last year? Remember the one from last year? Nah, this is like that, but way better.
Think about how much more you know now about this space than you ever did before.
And
I mean... You've grown so much in your knowledge. Our knowledge has grown. Even if you gave the exact same session as last year with the same abstract and everything, it would be a completely different, better session.
But right. There's no doubt about it that the industry has changed as well.
Yeah. What has changed? I mean, I've been reading your book. So your book is called Enterprise Mobility Management. I think that's it, right?
The subtitle is... Everything you need to know, or what is it? I keep on. Everything you really need to know about MDM, MAM, and BYOD.
Right. And the book, the writing is done. I've been reading it myself over the past, I don't know, week or two. I know right now you're just sort of in the final phases of working with the copy editor and getting it all buttoned up and everything. And you're looking at the Kindle version will be available in the next. Soon, right? 2-3 weeks, something like that?
Yeah, I was going to push for Bri Forum, but now it looks like, yeah, 2 or 3 weeks by
Bri
June.
Bri Forum, Chicago, right. So But I mean,
by the end of the month.
But so what has happened? I mean, you know, so you've been looking in the space, in the kind of EMM space. I mean, what are the big changes?
Well,
that have happened? Is it you're knowing more in the last year, or did the industry actually change the past year?
Well, there is that I've spent, you know, nets many more hours on it now than I have a year ago. But a year ago, we had mobile device management companies and we had mobile application management companies. And we had a year ago was also before, you know, before AppSense and before Citrix announced mobility management products. A year ago, Symantec had just recently acquired MDM and MAM. And so what happened in that meantime? This MDM thing went from being sort of just a thing that a few specialty smaller companies had to being something that, well, one, that pretty much all of the companies have now. And number two, and the more important thing, is that all of these companies have both mobile device management and mobile application management that combine to form the larger, greater world of enterprise mobility management. So before, when there used to be debates about, you know, like whether you manage at a device level or forget that and do at the app level, it was like, you know, bitter one vendor another against another in marketing battles. Like, that part of the debate is over now, because all of the serious vendors pretty much have both. So now when you're talking about how you want to approach enterprise mobility, you can have that discussion without having it be a vendor discussion.
It's interesting. That's actually kind of how it's been in the desktop virtualization space too, because where in the old days with terminal server versus VDI versus client VMs, and now we're sort of saying like how you deliver it doesn't matter. Like you have to, your solutions have to encompass sort of all of those. And then you got to figure out how to manage Windows and that kind of stuff. I guess in that sense, it's not entirely the same. But there's the whole thing, like, it's not a battle. Like, yeah, we get this. These are both useful. Actually, that's the section of your book I read last night about when MDM. Because I was thinking with MAM, managing the app level, it's like, well, shoot, why do you even need MDM? And I think in the book you laid out well. You still need MDM. Like, MDM is good for the initial device configuration, just like putting certificates and getting all the, you know, accounts and VPNs and all that kind of stuff set up. And then also MDM is great for devices that are, I think you defined it as like the users don't take home with them at night. So it's the kiosk devices. It's if you're the insurance salesman or the pilot who's using the iPad as the virtual charts, all that kind of stuff. Like, that's where MDM is great, because you want to completely lock that down and not allow them to change it. And that's fine, because in those cases, they probably are not using that as their primary mobile device anyway. Like, they probably already have a separate phone or tablet for personal use.
Yeah, so while we focus a lot on the enterprise users that we think of with their highly personal devices and that get taken anywhere, there's still all of that whole other scenario. Although, as an interesting note, and we're kind of wandering off on a tangent here. But even like with those, you know, lockdown kiosk devices that people don't take home at night, there are all sorts of stories. And the most recent one that I can think of recently was written up by James Furbish, the search consumerization tech target writer, that like, you know, yeah, you may think like, oh, it's, you know, just it's replacing an old embedded device, so we can lock it down. Don't allow the users to install any apps. But even then, like, the story was that there was some telco or cable company or something in the East Coast out by there, and like the field technicians realized like, hey, we can go and download this Google Translate app. And then we can save a whole bunch of time when we go to somebody's house and they don't, and you know, it's a customer that doesn't speak English. And instead of having to like call, you know, the technician that speaks another language, they just pull out Google Translate, and like right there, they've saved, you know, tons and tons of money. So like,
God,
that's sort of.
But then again, that could be also, that's awesome on one hand, but now you're making like medical decisions based on Google Translate. So did I say anterior? No. I mean posterior.
Hey, I said it was not a, you know, it wasn't a medical company. It was a.
It wasn't a medical. Okay.
It was like a cable company. So.
All right.
in that case. So it,
no,
it,
I that's... said I do not have HBO on 16 TVs in my house.
Well, you know, that's just one of those examples that goes to show, you know, when we're talking about getting down in the weeds of all this mobility stuff, that like it's one of those happy rainbows examples of, hey, this is why like consumerization is really cool.
Yeah. So, I, you know, while we're kind of on this mobility track, and I still believe, by the way, like we have so many conversations internally about Briform and like, did we do the right thing or the wrong thing by bringing, bringing mobility into Briform? I mean, I believe it's the right thing, but I guess that's because it was my idea. And that, you know, Briform has always evolved, because in the early days it was just Citrix and Terminal Server. There was no even VDI in it, you know. And then when we added app virtualization, people were like, "Nah, this is BS. You're ruining Briform." Then when we added, you know, VDI, it's the same thing. And then consumerization and all this kind of stuff. So I still believe that mobility really matters to those of us who are sort of end user computing, desktop people, because we're the ones who are delivering applications to laptops and stuff. And now our users are using iPads. And if we just deliver the same app to the iPads, you know, they're just going to kind of like, I don't know. I feel like it's mobility is not just a phone person, BlackBerry Exchange kind of thing. So I guess I'm just saying this to defend my decision and to defend also why I'm asking you all these questions right now. Yeah. And like what Gunnar says is, all the stuff is mobility, TSVDI, MDM. So it all makes sense. Yeah. So
that's
go on.
So that's the answer. If somebody's like, why are you guys writing so much about iPhones?
Well, and what's interesting too is I'm not writing about iPhones and Gabe is not writing about iPhones. Just you are, and you're new. So I'm writing the same amount and Gabe is like, we are writing more. The website has more about that, but we're not sacrificing other content to replace it with iPhone content. We're just adding iPhone, you know, quote unquote iPhone. We're just adding mobility content in addition to the other stuff. If you don't like it, I guess just click on the desktop virtualization and just read. You know, you can click on the desktop virtualization topic and just subscribe to that feed instead of the whole site feed. But anyway, my point is, Jack, so and we haven't actually talked about this. So on the mobile space, like in your book, you outline a lot of changes that both Google and Apple have made to Android and iOS to sort of make them more enterprise friendly. And we don't have to go into all the details now, but like in the earlier versions of iOS, it was not manageable. Then they added Exchange Active Sync support. Then they added, you know, over-the-air configuration and lockdown and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So, but now both Google I.O. and Apple Worldwide Developer Conference are coming up in the next month or two. So I assume we're going to hear about iOS 7 and we're going to hear about Android, I don't even know what's next, 4.3 or 5 or whatever it's going to be. But from the have you heard anything from the enterprise standpoint, like from the enterprise management standpoint, has there been any talk about what features might be added to these OSs?
Well, so this is a really tough question, and this is also what I plan on writing about for tomorrow for the article for the website. So it's good that we can hash out some of these issues now. You're right. So like those two articles last week, and you know, you can see the story where iOS and Android went from being completely wild and unmanageable to, yes, we can manage them and lock them down. And then the story that we're telling now is that, okay, locking down, being able to manage a phone is great. It solves the problems of the last decade. But now our new set of problems is dealing with both the personal stuff and the work stuff being on the same device together and preventing them from intermingling. And you know, we try to do this with desktop virtualization or with web apps or with even virtualizing the entire phone. And you know, right now one of the best ways though that's emerging to do that is, you know, a lot of people believe mobile application management, which you know, I truly believe that that's the best way to deal with this issue. But there are a lot of ways that, yeah, if these platforms did evolve, like we could tackle this dual persona issue in an even better way. So will these platforms evolve to handle this new problem? And what could that look like? And what would it be is the big question.
It seems like there's some easy wins, because, for example, I know that both with iOS and Android, with iOS you can configure whether apps have access to certain phone features like camera and location and that kind of stuff. I don't know. Like, so, I just feel, and with the Android, it shows you, like, because in Android, it shows you this app is requesting the following sets of permissions, and it shows you a list of, like, six of them. And if I could have an app by app, a permissions by permission switch that I could centrally control,
if that permissions, you mean, was exposed to management.
Yeah.
So exactly. If it was either in the configuration profile or part of an API.
Yeah. Yeah.
So here's the problem with that, and I thought about this like you know, basically there are these they're frameworks like Contacts and you know, being able to cut and paste and stuff. These frameworks enabled by the operating system that allow apps to communicate with each other, and some of the sensitive frameworks you can control applications access to them on iOS. That is, you know, you can control on an individual basis, but like. So yeah, being able to control applications' access to the contacts, exposing that to management, that would be great. But I don't think that would completely solve the problem. And so I was thinking in my mind and trying to write out, like, what all would you need to add so that basically you have, like, a secure framework that approved apps can access, and, you know, then the usual frameworks for everything else. And it's like, okay, well, we need, like, a secure version of the clipboard, and we need a mail client where you can specify what apps are allowed to access information related to that Exchange account. And it just gets more and more and more complicated, because you keep on having to add in all of these other frameworks. So you think, like, what about devices that need this, and what about devices that need that? That's why operating system level dual persona is really complicated, and, you know, the like BlackBerry 10 OS was designed about it. Samsung Knox was designed around it. The bottom line is that it's just something that's so complex. There's no way that I could see Apple making that change.
But is there things they can do? Okay, so Apple's not going to go out and, like, render the whole MDM, MAM, EMM industry irrelevant overnight. But is there things that Apple can do to iOS that would help what the EMM vendors need? Or do the EMM vendors like the things the way they are, since they're very, you know, much needed now?
So there are a few. They're short of dual persona. Fine, dual personifying iOS. There are some things that Apple could do, and, you know, we've seen them move in this direction in the past. And, like, one of the main things is, you know, we talk about this issue with third-party mail clients, because, you know, what you do in MAM is you create your set of corporate apps, and you use various ways. You have various ways for them to communicate with each other. You know, custom URL schemes or going through the device frameworks, but putting only encrypted data into the device frameworks. Like, if you cut and paste from one work app to another app through the device's clipboard, the device clipboard only sees encrypted data, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so this is all well and good. And you can see even that change to Gmail, the Gmail iOS app that was released yesterday. Did you guys see this?
Yeah. What was that?
So it's where, you know, in
Business Insider scooped you, man, didn't they?
What's that?
Didn't Business Insider scoop you on that?
Yeah.
it happens.
But so what this is, like, in the Gmail iOS app, you know, ordinarily you click on a link and either it opens within like a browser instance that's, like, built in to the Gmail app, or you open it externally and it'll open into Safari. But now you can have an option where you click on a link and it opens into Chrome for iOS, a completely separate different app.
So, and how do they do that? Does Apple, like, how's that okay with Apple? Because I thought Apple was blocking that.
No. That's actually something that's completely fine and has been a part of Apple and has been a part of iOS for a long time. Mobile application management companies have been doing this for a long time. What is it's, you know, so when if you have an app, there's a URL, you can call the URL, you know, to open up a link in Safari or open up, you know, like the mail to yeah. link in the built-in mail app. And so they're like standard URL schemes that your app can use to do that. But they're also there's what's known as custom URL schemes, which like you just you know, with the information in your apps, you just register like, hey, when when Gmail yeah. says like call up Chrome, it's
Chrome colon slash slash or something like that, and it causes iOS handler to sort of throw it out to the
So that's been possible for a long time. MAM companies have been doing it for a long time. So it was really only a matter of time before Google would start doing this with their apps. And like Google's collection of apps and the way that they sort of usurp all of the built-in iOS functionality, that's like the exact same model that's the exact same thing that mobile app management aspires to do.
Well, so now we got to see if Google can do things like passing encrypted URLs or something like that from Gmail to Chrome, you know, so that like you couldn't open it in Safari if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But now the question is, though, but this comes to a good point. So, but the Gmail app, the main downside of the Gmail app in iOS is that it can't download email in the background.
Yeah.
Because Apple blocks that. And that's the same as other EMM vendors. So, like all these EMM vendors, they have their own apps, which are, you know, third-party email apps, which are awesome because they have, you know, they're manageable and they respect.
And they have their custom URLs to open other apps. And...
But they can't open mail in the back. They can't download mail in the background, right?
Right, exactly. So,
wait, you can't?
say again?
I said, wait, they can't?
No. They can
claiming that they could, right?
They can, that's an interesting issue. They can get notifications in the background, but when the app is closed, it can receive a push notification. Basically some sort of server or proxy or something realizes that there's a new mail. It's through the Apple push notification service gateway. It sends a push notification to your phone. Unfortunately, in iOS, that push notification is not able to wake up the app on its own to make it go download the message.
Apple does not allow the app to automatically wake up to do something based on push notifications.
Right, exactly.
For third-party apps. They allow it for their own apps, but just not for third-party apps.
Yeah, well, I think what it... So, like, their own apps, it may look like it's doing it, but I think what they're... This is... Like in reality, what most of their own apps are doing is more just they're just actually running in the background.
Oh,
like
so Apple's breaking a different rule.
Yeah. It's, you know, the do as we say, not as we do, and all that stuff.
You sound like my dad.
Yeah. So the number one thing that Apple could do to sort of help the MAM industry is just like get rid of. Get rid of those restrictions around background running. And, you know, these restrictions, they were designed with good intention because, remember, we're talking about a mobile device here. This doesn't have, all the power to run, you know, a million processes like your desktop does. And if you remember back in the early days of Android, of course, Android is much less restrictive around background processes. And in the early days of Android, you go and like you would get a task killer application that would like identify everything that was going on in the background and like kill it because Android wasn't very good at handling all that. Now Android got better at that, but these task killer applications are still popular regardless. But you know, today maybe some of these restrictions don't quite make sense anymore in light of the needs that we have.
Especially if you look at, so if an iPhone 5S comes out and it's like A9 quad core, it's like, really, man, I can't run my mail in the background.
Well, yeah. I would imagine part of it, like you were saying, it's not, they didn't do this with malicious intent, and there's nothing, I don't think there's anything to, you know, Apple trying to maintain some sort of competitive advantage. I think that they're trying to preserve the device experience, and if there's these apps running in the background kind of unchecked, then that's having an effect on battery life and that sort of thing. So
yeah, I was just gonna say, Gunnar said yeah, it's a battery thing, especially when, like, man, you're trying to, like, cram this device thinner and lighter and stuff, and so maybe the total milliamp hours of the battery is decreasing, and like some other parts in the development company says, like, come on, we want, like, free it up. And the other people are saying, like, you know, people are gonna bitch way too much if your battery only doesn't last all day.
But then,
so
again,
there's got to be a middle ground then. I mean, there's got to be something where Apple can allow email applications to run in the background or something. And I realize that some other companies will take advantage of that and call their thing email, even though it's not email, to get background sync and that sort of a thing. But you would think that Apple could make it so that certain applications have the ability to receive background or to run in the background all the time.
Yeah.
While, you know, Joe Horrible Coder can't make it so that his 3D game somehow runs in the background constantly.
Well, there is the other thing.
The other workaround to this is that you can write apps that run in the background. They just won't be approved. So
you have to deliver them via enterprise certs, right?
Right. So that, and maybe you know this, Jack. So that could be, like, maybe you're a MAM vendor, and who knows how legal this is, but you're an EMM vendor, and you say, yeah, you just get your mail app from us because it runs in the background, delivers all your mail, and Apple won't approve it, but, you know, we'll give it to you directly.
Yeah. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of EMM vendors about this issue, and it's definitely it's a gray area where you know, they don't like to talk about it publicly. And, you know, some guidance from Apple sure would be nice.
Okay. So you'll be covering both. Going back to it. So Google I/O and Apple Worldwide Developer Conference, you'll be covering both of those in terms of, like, the enterprise specific advancements to Android and iOS.
Yes.
I want to sort of move on beyond the mobile stuff, but I also know that, you know, we had that thing called WorkSpot. So, like, one more mobile thing. Harry Labana posted a blog on our website last week, I think, about WorkSpot. And so WorkSpot, to me, it just seems like it's an app. I don't know, how would you describe it? Like, it's an app. It's like an app you run on your phone or your tablet that connects you into, like, network shares and SharePoint and stuff like that.
So WorkSpot is a browser. If you think about it that way. And so WorkSpot, like, there's the administrative end that you use to plug the clients into your VPN. And, you know, set up all the URLs of your intranet and all your web apps and everything. And then, you know, because basically, like, everything is contained in this managed browser. You solve, like, you don't have to worry about the device. You don't have to, you know, worry about MDM. You have that separation, you know, that you like. And, hey, it solves a lot of problems. And that's really great. But the problem is that it does a lot of things in the browser and not in native apps, like, you know, like email, for example. Since everything with the WorkSpot solution is browser based, like, that means that your solution for email is OWA. And, you know, if we're talking, we're complaining about apps that are native apps that can do everything except for download in the background. And, like, we're talking a few levels below that level of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I, like,
there. Now I can only use my email. Now I can only use my email if I'm connected. So now there's not download in the background. I have to be connected to use the client. And the other thing, people say, oh, there's always connections all over the world now, which is true, except when I'm using apps that require online, it just makes everything slow. Like, every time I click on a link, every time I click on a message, I have to wait, you know, 5 seconds for that message to download, versus if it's a local app, I can just cycle through my messages really quickly.
And quite possibly expensive, too, especially if you're thinking international, you know, having data roaming on a device and that sort of thing. I mean, data may be everywhere, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's free.
And it's not everywhere, like the subway, the plane, the, you know, Muni Metro
directly
has...
Directly in front of my house.
Muni Metro has all sorts of issues and that it needs to solve here in San Francisco.
But
and
the slowness, I think, to me, yeah.
I think providing 4G coverage, you know, in the subway is probably not as high on the list as being able to actually make the subway run.
Very true. The other thing about WorkSpot is that there's an offline component to it as well, and that's what sets it apart from – there's a couple other solutions I can think of in the same vein, like Armor 5. And so there is an offline component where documents can be saved within this application sandbox or, you know, container, whatever you want to call it. And so they can be viewed offline. Apparently, there's some element of being able to edit documents with built-in viewers, not like the PowerPoint viewer, but an actual app that's sort of feature built into WorkSpot.
I thought it just
so there
used...
is some ability to edit things, but then they're saved back. I mean, they're stored locally and synced back to whatever storage solution this thing ties into as well. I'm just not a big believer in that method, especially the way it's pitched, which is an alternative to MDM or a way to embrace BYO.
Yeah.
That's like saying PDI is alternative to MDM. You know?
And, well, okay. So what Harry was saying is that, you know, MDM, like device management itself, is rapidly being commoditized, and that may be true, and that MDM doesn't actually do that much in terms of giving you access to corporate data. And that's true as well. But the, you know, anytime something comes along and claims to solve BYOD, you know, my alarms go off in my head. And, you know, it seems like everybody's looking to find a really easy answer for mobile. And, you know, like we talk about those issues, you know, with getting manageable apps into the ecosystem for, you know, if you're doing MAM, and that's a whole other conversation for another time. And yes, there are some issues, but there's not going to be a silver bullet, and it's just something that we have to work on and figure out. And the good news is that we're dealing with like operating systems that were designed this decade, or well, last decade, this century.
So, yeah, I mean, the WorkSpot to me just seemed like it was nice. It uses your existing VPN.
Yeah, like
that's the main thing I got.
It's nice, and like the freemium model, you know, like they start out offering by free, is great too. But like enterprise mobility management is, you know, it's not going to like. I think it's a very solvable, doable problem, even with the limitations that we have today. It's just that like one single app, it's going to be more complicated than like just doing VDI and calling it a day, or just doing one app and calling it a day.
Okay, so let's move on to what everyone is talking about in the chat room right now, which is Mahoro. Mahoro?
And yeah, I don't know.
Gabe, you wrote the article on this last week. You want to kind of – what is Mahoro?
Mahoro, in the one-sentence version, is Microsoft's rumored service that will provide Windows desktops from the cloud. From their own, yeah, from Azure. Yeah. So now that alone is open to some interpretation, because what does that really mean? Does that mean – RDSH desktops? Does that mean VDI desktops? And the differentiation there is really critical, because as we've talked about before, and why Guy, I'm sure, is in the forums talking about this, is that, you know, currently DAS providers cannot provide Windows 7 VDI desktops on in a cloud scenario on multi-tenant hardware. You know, I can't run company A's desktops on the same server VDI host as company B's desktops. So if you remember a few months ago, we had Dan Brinkman and Jarian Gibson on. We were talking about that, you know, what would happen if Microsoft decided to have a cloud-based desktop solution? Would they have to follow their own EULA and adhere to their own policies? And so this conversation has been rekindled with this announcement. Obviously, if that was the case, DAS providers would be seriously pissed off about that. What we so far have learned is that most people seem to think that this is RDS only. And so if we're talking about strictly session host desktops being delivered from Azure, that's perfectly fine to do in a multi-tenant way based on the EULA that's currently in place for that. So this all kind of depends on how it's interpreted and what Microsoft actually means. But the problem is that this is all just rumored, as reported by Mary Jo Foley, who, you know, gets the credit for the break here. She, or for the scoop. And so even she cited one person who I believe was part of Microsoft saying that this is like RDSH. So I guess we still have to see. Maybe Microsoft will actually come out with an actual announcement and some information on this. But until then, it's just speculation. But I should say all signs are pointing towards it being an RDSH solution as opposed to a VDI solution.
So, okay. So if it's RDSH, I mean, so first of all, I would say this does fall within sort of what my best guess is how the future Windows is going to work. Like, I wrote these articles in the past about Windows being middleware and that kind of stuff, like evolving into middleware.
Oh, yeah. The pieces of that puzzle are coming together nicely.
Yeah, which is a little unsettling because I've made a lot of predictions in the past that have all been just horribly, horribly wrong. And so I don't know if this is like...
You're throwing a shit on a wall. Some of it's bound to stick.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously, like, the whole, you know, if you go back to the Microsoft's future and moving towards touch-based stuff and Windows, all apps from the Windows Store, that's all seems fine. But then, you know, how you deal with old school apps that are, you know, old traditional desktop Windows applications. And I always sort of figured that's where serving them from the data center would make sense. And then I wondered, do people want to do that themselves? And so maybe if Microsoft had a service, like a legacy Windows application service, that seems interesting to me. So I don't know that I believe that Microsoft is going to deliver your desktop, air quotes, lowercase d. Like, what I mean is, you know, I talk about
desktops,
like,
and applications, I guess. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because like I talk about, I mean, yeah, like I don't see that, I don't imagine that users are going to use Mahoro as the primary place where they go every day, and the remote Windows desktop is their aggregation point of their data and their apps and their web links and their personality. I don't think that's the case. I more of see this as delivering legacy applications out to users. Although maybe now there's not a good way to integrate all that stuff. I don't know. But like, it'd be kind of nice if for a company to be like, oh man, yeah, I want to use this new Windows tablet, but I don't really have a place to, what am I going to do with my old apps? If Microsoft would be like, oh, your old apps, $4 a month right here, then that might be like a kind of cool use case for it.
But can we?
Yeah, and that is the culmination of that speculation that you had, where, you know, Windows does become middleware. And there's a lot of people that share that opinion, myself included, but a lot of the people that we talk to, some of them in the chat room right now. Did you notice some of them are also talking about using it just in kind of the classic skirting the rules method of delivering desktops from the cloud, which is if you just deploy single server 2008 R2 instances or 2012, I guess, too, to users, then that becomes a multi-tenant VDI solution, but it's based mm-hmm. on Windows Server OS instead of Windows Desktops OS.
Yeah. So you buy a data center license, and then you still need an RDS cal for all of them, but at least it's legal.
Yeah.
So that is technically legal?
Yeah, because like in that case...
Confirmed by Microsoft and everything?
Oh, yeah. For sure. Like, I'll confirm it.
Okay.
Because they don't care. I mean, because, yeah, so if you're using remote desktop, if you're using RDSH, you are allowed to have as you know different companies on the same hardware, and you're allowed to break it up to as many VMs. If you buy a data center copy of Windows, you're allowed to run as many VMs as you want. The only thing is you have to still buy the RDS cal for that.
So you know what I see here is kind of, especially if, you know, considering that our client bucket of, you know, our aggregation point for personality and all that bucket of stuff, you know, the Microsoft can do what it wants with Windows as a client, and, you know, we can do what we want with the client. But it seems to me this is going to the point, like the VDI versus terminal server conversation. Like, is it just me, or is that conversation, except for the licensing aspect, getting less and less relevant, or maybe not quite as important as it used to be?
In what way?
Because first of all, if we're not as concerned about delivering as many elements of the user's personality, and that's more taken care of by the clients, and then like more, no matter what we're doing, we're just delivering, you know, just apps, yeah, and not the full big desktop experience. So there the differences, you know, would be less crucial. And, you know, as we talked about with, that was one of your articles, maybe, like mentioning, like, you know, with Moore's law and advancements in storage and everything, that, you know, the difficulties of doing VDI are less now.
Well, yeah, so that's what I wrote in this article. I mean, it was interesting because you could make an argument that if you believe that Windows desktop apps will be delivered remotely and you're delivering like just single apps, just the user interface, then that's a no-brainer for terminal servers. So traditional thinking would be, oh, that means terminal servers' days, terminal server will rise again, and terminal servers' best days are ahead of it. And that's what I thought for a few years also, and I wrote about that a couple years ago, like, oh my gosh, it's all going to be terminal server. But then I started thinking about it more, and I'm like, you know, terminal server is still weird and different, and you still have different, like, weird things with application compatibility and the whole, like, multiple users on the same box and that kind of thing. And then I look at, man, you know, our hypervisors are getting better and better at economizing lots of VMs, and hardware is, like, Moore's law fixes stuff, and hardware is so cheap now. I almost want to say, man, screw it. If I got one app to deliver, I'm going to build a Windows desktop VM with just the app installed and use, in this case, non-persistent desktop and just, like, spawn up a VM instance for every user who needs that thing. And then maybe that way, like, I'm still using it. I'm using VDI like a terminal server, but it's still being used with the desktop OS because that way it's the same OS I've got throughout my entire enterprise. So
But that RDS being weird and different, that's also, isn't that also a lot less of an issue than it used to be?
Well, I would argue that if server and desktop were functionally were literally identical, then we would not be having this conversation about Microsoft not licensing Windows 7 for you know, desktop as a service. Because we would all be happy with, oh, well, we can do it on server, and that's fine. So
yeah, and part of the reason it's weird and different is the policies that you have to have in place as well to run terminal server, which just make the experience different for the user. So there, you're right. The OSs are more similar in user experience in terms of, you know, button and look and feel and that sort of a thing. But there's still other things that have to be done to make that more... to make a terminal server more usable than a VDI box. Now, like what we're talking about here, though, with running individual instances of Server 2008, you know, it's still a little bit weird, but you're right. The gap is fairly narrow there. It's just about cost. Like, do you have data center? Are you willing to go that route, or what are you trying to solve with this?
Well, and we also still have, I mean, I don't know. There's still weird applications that are like, oh, I'm on a server. I'm not going to run.
Yeah, for sure.
So, if Mahoro is all just RDS, then, like, great, we already have that in the world today.
Yeah, like, there's already hosting companies who are hosting that kind of stuff.
So,
where did I lose my chat in the room? Yeah, so that's the thing. Like, so I don't know how big the story is. I mean, Microsoft.
Yeah, because, like, if that's the case, then, like, it's okay. It's not nearly as big of a story.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, like that's...
The only way this would be a huge story is if, look, all the roofers just left in one van. I could go into my house right now.
Are they done?
They are not done. No, lunchtime. so the only way that this is a really big deal is if they start to deliver Windows 7 or Windows 8 or whatever VDI desktops from the cloud in a multi-tenant fashion and... ignore the EULA that everybody else has to follow. That's the way this becomes this, you know, ridiculously crazy thing that Microsoft has done. Otherwise, it's just something cool that you can do with Azure. So, I mean, yeah. And someone else, to wait.
Yeah, and someone else said something about, I mean, Amazon has this. You know, like you can run Windows instances, server instances out of Amazon EC2. And someone else was just kind of saying, like, you know, this is just them catching up with. It's not. This isn't even them like making any kind of big major strategy shift about what. Oh my God, what does this mean for desktops? It's just like, oh, Amazon's doing this. We have to also. So it's about Azure versus AWS more so.
Yeah,
than,
that's your point. And to be fair, Azure has been able to run Windows VHDs in the cloud for a few years now. I think it was 2009 or 10 that I wrote an article about that. Maybe it was 11. I don't know. They all blend together now. But still, it's been a couple of years since you've been able to upload VHDs into Azure and access them via RDP, except now this looks like a structured service associated around that, not just something that you could probably cobble together.
So you know what this means, which is kind of interesting as a little side note. I believe in 2011... I delivered my TS versus VDI, and I said it was going to be the last time I delivered that session. But I think I could deliver another session on that now, based on what we were just talking about. And it's funny because, you know, we first gave that session in 2007, then I delivered it again in 2009, then in 2011. But every 2 years, it was a different session, like legitimately different. Like way, like my thinking had changed.
You can put together a DVD box set of them.
I could, what's a DVD?
Right.
But I could have, I mean, I believe that I could have now a conversation. Gabe, maybe we'll do this as one of our 15-minute sessions at Briform. Because there is a different conversation there to be like, in the past, look, it was, and now, like, looking, yeah, like the article I did the other day about, hey, you know, Moore's Law fixes a lot of stuff, so maybe I'm not as interested in TS as I was. Anyway, all right, what are these guys talking about here in the thing? Daz done right, software assurance. Sorry, I was fell out of forums for a minute. So, Gabe, you also wrote about Dell vWorkspace version 8.
Yeah.
The
story behind that is kind of interesting. What's that?
No, yeah, go on.
Oh, I was just gonna, if you had a specific question, but the story behind that was kind of interesting just because we didn't actually learn about that. We got very used to the back in the Quest days of getting advance notice and, you know, interviews with guys like Rob Malicode or Patrick Rouse or Michelle or Rick Mack, that kind of a thing, John Rules. And so this time around, the announcement kind of came and went, and it never really left the Quest or the vWorkspace blogs. And so somebody actually asked me a question about what I thought about Quest. And so I thought, you know, I should look into this to see if they've done anything. And sure enough, I found out that vWorkspace 8 came out. So,
oh, my God. I should see if they've done anything. Oh, wow, a whole new version of product.
Yeah, yeah. But and I went back through emails. I looked to see if their PR had reached out, and maybe I ignored it because that happens. Or missed it. I'd say missed. sometimes ignored. I would not have ignored a Quest one or a Dell one. But I had nothing. So I did a little bit of investigation, you know, learned the new features, tried to learn the ins and outs of them, and then put this article together that kind of went through what it was all about. And so the short version is vWorkspace 8 updated to work with Server 2012 and Windows 8. That means that both RDSH, RDVH, and also Hyper-V3 are all supported in this. So in Server 2012 and with Windows 8. It also means that currently Dell vWorkspace is the number one product that can deliver RDSH on Server 2012 besides Microsoft itself. Because Citrix doesn't have a solution for it, obviously VMware, but Teradici doesn't have a solution for Server 2012 yet. So the three companies that can deliver RDSH or augment RDSH on Server 2012 are Dell vWorkspace, 2X, and a small business company called Desktop Sites that's focused on just small business deployments for desktop virtualization projects. So beyond that, though, beyond just modernizing it for Server 2012 and Windows 8, they've also added some functionality to their Catalyst features, the Hypercache and Hyperdeploy. And of those, I'm not entirely sure how they all work, but they've just kind of changed. They've extended Hypercache so that it can also not only optimize VDI workloads, but also optimize the disk usage in RDSH workloads as well, which essentially is just caching the most frequently used bits in memory. And then HyperDeploy is the catalyst feature that is effectively letting you boot a VDI image before it's finished actually copying to the box, deploying to a box to start it up. And that has also been extended in a way that changes how those bits are allocated and stores some of those things in memory to some of those more commonly used ones to reduce the disk footprint for VDI machines. So I have yet to get a briefing on that. I should do that in the next week or two. But so those are the big changes. They've also increased the level of integration with the Foglight product that Quest had, that they had started to include in vWorkspace 7.5 or 7.6. And now they can do a bunch of user experience monitoring that includes insights into what's happening in the protocol between the client and the endpoint, the client and the data center. They can correlate stuff that's happening on the endpoint and in the data center together to help trace down problems. And really, I mean, it's something that they have been working on for a while and people have been asking for a while, because the Foglight features have always been kind of hanging out there and people have been wondering when they were ever going to actually integrate it. And so this seems to be the next level of that. So the bottom line with all of this is that despite the relative amount of radio silence that we've gotten, Dell appears to still be committed to vWorkspace. And I wonder if the silence isn't because in the article that I wrote, I speculated that it was just a change in the path of communication, right? Like, we used to just have a direct line to the product manager, and now we don't. And maybe now everything has to go through Dell PR, so it's a slower process, and we just weren't on their lists or something like that. I actually wonder if it has more to do with they don't want to have any negative impact on their partnerships with VMware and Citrix, because those are still alive and well. And we've heard in the past that Dell cherishes those. So I would imagine that continuing development on vWorkspace 8 is, you know, that's already pushing the line a little bit between partner and competitor. I would take that one step further and say, if you create a new product that competes with VMware and Citrix, that's fine. But when you start marketing the hell out of it, then it becomes competition. So I have a feeling that that's why it hasn't been really talked about or announced that much, is because then it would be perceived as outright competition against their very close partners.
I wonder what Dell has to lose, though. Like, so what if they compete against it? Like, is Citrix going to be like, don't use our stuff on Dell?
I don't know. I have no idea. I do not envy the position that Dell's in right now, having a product that competes with them.
Well, I do not envy Dell for a lot of reasons, but
but I would imagine that that's a fine line to walk, because if Citrix, they don't want, I wonder what would happen if one of them got mad and then quit having the relationship with Dell, and then the other one, you know, if Citrix quit the relationship with Dell, but VMware was still there, maybe VMware would love to see that and Citrix would hate, but. Yeah, I don't know. But they would still have to deal with the fact that there was still a competitor from their same company. But, I highly doubt you're going to see managed service solutions or managed solutions from Dell that incorporate vWorkspace the same way you do VMware and Citrix.
Yeah, I guess that's – but I just wonder how much that's – I mean, you know, you talk about quit the relationship. Like, what's that mean really? Oh, fine, so Dell's not going to Synergy? I mean,
no,
so what? You know what I'm saying? Like,
it's the fact that they sell pre-made solutions or – they sell turnkey solutions that businesses can take in-house, and they sell a managed solution that leverages both Zen Desktop VDI in a box and VMware View. So this is an actual business for them that they don't want to lose by pissing off VMware or Citrix with their own product. And if that happened, then sure, they would just start, you know, pitching out that they can use vWorkspace instead. But, you know, that's their decision, whether they want to hang their hat on vWorkspace or whether they want to leverage their relationships.
But, like, can Citrix even stop them from offering that service? You know what I mean? Like, if Citrix gets mad at Dell, let's say hypothetically, like, Citrix gets pissed off at Dell.
Yeah.
Okay,
I think
so
they
what?
Can make it, like, more expensive.
I don't know, because, like, the – Yeah.
There's probably some sort of benefit in terms of cost savings that Dell has right now by having a alliance with Citrix. But they also have them with VMware. So you're right in that regard, where, you know, they've already got two competing solutions based on competing products, but then it gets more complex when you throw in their own competing product.
See, that's what I'm saying. I think we give too much credit to the organization. I mean, granted, it's been 10 years, but, you know, when I was working at HP, that shit was, it was not, I don't know. At least no one knows what anyone is doing. You know, like, all the stuff is sort of, like, just put together, and I can imagine, like, all the conference calls we were on about pre-synergy planning, like Citrix alliance planning and all this kind of stuff, and it's all, like, marketing crap. Like, oh, we got to make this offering, get this SKU made, and get this press release out, and all this kind of stuff. But, like, what's actually mean in the back end? Like, I don't think that anyone knows what's actually happening.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to see VWorkspace work, but I can't imagine they're, like, doing all this kind of stuff because of Citrix, because I what pull does Citrix really have? Like, Citrix is going to say, oh, yeah, then fine, we're not going to, like, they can't stop them, so what, like, they're going to not give them as much of a price, as much margin, so then they're just going to use VMware. I don't know. I just can't imagine that Citrix really has any say on that.
I would just imagine that that the products that they have built on Citrix and VMware are probably worth more to them than the revenue that they get on VWorkspace.
Well, yeah, that's probably true.
So that's the thing that they have to worry about. Because, you know, there's VWorkspace customers out there that they don't want to piss off. But hell, if they pissed them off, maybe they'll go buy Dell Managed Solutions. But
can they use any – does anything Dell is doing with VWorkspace integrate with, like, any Citrix stuff?
So VWorkspace has the ability – the web interface for VWorkspace will actually also connect to Citrix systems. Like, so you – can use it as your web interface into Citrix app, you know, remote desktop applications and desktops as well. So there is some level of integration there. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, and just like Foglight, like, can you buy Foglight to plug into Citrix's stack? Like, I wonder if they're selling anything like that, you know?
I would imagine that's there. The Foglight features that they talk about are more related to, there's the obvious server side. Client-side metrics, but there's a lot that it can do digging into EOP as well. That's another question I have that I need to ask directly of like Michelle or Patrick, is what is EOP actually doing now? Because remote effects, the enhancements to remote effects in the last 6 months or so with the release of Windows 8 and Server 2012 have sort of taken care of what EOP had done for the first edition of remote effects that we were using. So I wonder how much EOP is actually being used nowadays, or if they're working on other enhancements that they can add to the stack. So, you know, that we've got to look into that as well.
Yeah.
Gunner brings up something in the chat room too about what happens when or if sales reps get more money for selling VWorkspace, and so all of a sudden that affects the partnership some more, and then that could hurt Wyze. So there's an added dimension of it to this whole thing, which, again, I just cannot be envious in any way of of the situation. It's so crazy.
So, all right. So the last thing I want to say, we've got like just a minute before our hour ends. What about Synergy? So I'm not going to Synergy this year, which I'm just couldn't be happier about. And
this is the first one you missed in eons.
Eons since Synergy, but you guys, you know, you guys are going down there. So I don't know if there's anything. Is there news? Like, are we expecting news from this show? You know, I know it's just kind of like, yeah, here's all the stuff and that kind of thing. But where's Citrix with stuff? Like, are we on a news cycle where we're looking for new products and stuff from them, or
we're looking for updates for sure? You know that. They released the Excalibur and Merlin stuff as part of Avalon and Barcelona, and so we expect to see the next iteration of that, or the at least we actually I expect to get hands on that, because last time at the show was a lot of theory, and some versions of Excalibur have been out and so on, but I'm expecting to see sort of the next phase of that, which they road mapped out and should be coming out this this next week or in a couple of weeks. There's also the NVIDIA stuff, which I don't remember the specific names of all these features, but last in Barcelona, they talked about how they had the GPUs that they could allocate to specific users. And they hinted that it would be sometime in the first part of this year where the shared GPU technology from NVIDIA would come out. And so I would imagine that that's going to happen as well, although I haven't seen anything specifically about that. All the mobility stuff is cool, and I know Jack is, you know, looking forward to seeing that kind of thing. And, you know, there's definitely been some stuff that we can't really talk about. But we'll have our full plate, I'm sure.
Where is Citrix in mobility? Like, I know when you talk about EMM, Jack, you always sort of mention like Good, AirWatch, Mobile Iron. I feel like those are companies you mention most often. Where does Citrix kind of fall, like, with what they're doing in the EMM space?
Yeah, well, like, you know, since last summer and since Barcelona, you know, they've, like, when it comes to, like, checking off the features on the feature comparison matrix, they have, you know, just as much, if not more, as anybody. You know, the question is, like, you know, the powerhouse names, you know, in enterprise mobility management, you know, you probably think of them as, Zenprise that they acquired was one of them, but you think of AirWatch and Good, or rather AirWatch and Mobile Iron. And so the question is, like, does Citrix say, like, hey, you know, we do all this stuff and we also do this mobile stuff, or do they say, like, hey, we're going to be a big powerhouse among these other mobile vendors? And like Gabe said, it's a lot of, like, you know, there's been like 8 or 9 more months for the story to come together and for them to put things together and you know, to have more hands-on time. So no big news expected, really. Just like, you know, we want to see more signs of everything coming together and see how they're doing that.
They really seem to be. I mean, like, when they canceled Synergy in Europe, they replaced it with a bunch of shows that look like they're all mobility shows. And it looks like the agenda for this Synergy is also, like, very heavily sort of mobility focused.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. Well, that's all I've got. I don't know if you guys have anything else. Let's see, something.
We'll see you guys in a week in London for Bryform.
Yeah, so, right, we're all over there next week, and then next week in Bryform, London, 2 weeks at Synergy.
Sounds good.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you, everyone, for joining today, and happy birthday to you again, Jack. And we'll talk to you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.